Welcome to the Content and Media Matters podcast, a series of interviews with key leaders throughout the industry, all brought to you by the Content and Media team at Newco, a specialist global recruitment and executive search firm.
Welcome to the Content and Media Matters podcast. Your hosts today are me, Henry Johnson, consultant, and Jake Sparks, who heads up our cyber division over here at Newco. And we're delighted to be joined today by Bob Lyon, CEO of Edgio. Having held senior leadership positions for the past 20 years, Bob has worked to scale and grow businesses across the enterprise, cybersecurity, and now media and entertainment industry. From managing P&Ls of over 1 billion and leading global, multifunctional teams, Bob is now leading the path for Edgio. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thanks, Henry. I look forward to the conversation. I appreciate you having me on today.
Oh, no, a pleasure. And I mean, to get us started, we always like to ask people the first question. How did you first get into the content and media and the cybersecurity industry?
Well, I've spent my whole career in technology, particularly in scaled enterprise technology in different forms. And, you know, security, you can't get away from. I mean, security is, you look at any study out there and it's always number one or number two and top priorities for CISOs and CIOs and CTOs. And I grew up in my career through being a CIO and a CTO. So, you know, it's always been there. And I remember early in my career, you never really thought about this that much. Now you start there. You start the conversation with security. So it's changed quite a bit over the years.
No, most definitely. And I mean, taking a bit of a further look into the past, Bob, would you say that there is someone or something that's been the biggest influence on your career?
You know, I wouldn't say any one thing or one person. If I had to say one thing, I had early in my career, I started as an entrepreneur and, you know, I was a developer and I wrote a piece of software and, you know, turns out it solved a pretty nice problem in the marketplace. And I started a business and did really well with that. And, you know, I was young and pretty full of confidence and, you know, hey, I can go buy another business because I'm Bob, I can do anything and had a, you know, tremendous failure doing that. And so I was able to early in my career, you know, experience what works and how you drive success and, you know, how you create failure as well. And I think, and the failure was, you know, big enough and meaningful enough that it was very formative for how I thought about, you know, going to work every day the rest of my life. So, you know, it really shaped the way I think about things. You know, you got to have a plan. You got to understand exactly what your assumptions are. You've got to drive the details and manage the details and all those things. And so as much as at the time it was tough, it probably was the most important thing that happened to me and really shaped how I approach work, you know, from there forward. And you know, look, I spent the last 20 years doing turnarounds. And so a lot of those early formative experiences really helped me understand, you know, how you get in these messes and what you do to get out of them. And so it was good from that standpoint. It wasn't good at the time, but it was good afterwards.
Interesting. That old maxim, isn't it? That success is a poor teacher. Interesting.
Yeah, you know, so when you're younger, you know, it's tough because you're like, yeah, I'm not supposed to have these kind of experiences. And then later on, when I interview somebody and I ask them, you know, what's been, you know, their tough experience, if they say I haven't had any, I'm always worried about that because it usually means they even haven't pushed the envelope, they're not being honest, or they just, you know, haven't had one. And you know, your best lessons are some of your toughest lessons, I think, in life in general, but in business for sure.
No doubt.
Definitely. It could be such a humbling experience as well. But then what you learn from it is the important part. And I mean, possibly more on the positive side of things, Bob. What achievement are you most proud of across your career?
Yeah, boy, I don't know. I mean, personally, my, you know, obviously you bring up your kids and your family and that's your biggest, you know, achievement. And I have a foundation that I'm pretty proud of. From a career standpoint, I kind of look at every opportunity and, you know, kind of proud of it in its own way. You know, and they've all been different. I've been doing turnarounds. So some, you know, you're proud because you took a company that wasn't supposed to survive and you made it viable. And others, you took a company that, you know, wasn't growing as much as it needed to and could. And so they're just, you know, you're proud in different kind of ways. I think the most important thing for me is I try to go into every situation and, you know, my kind of measuring stick is, did I make it a better situation because I was involved? And if so, then great, then I'm proud of that. And if not, you know, then I'm a little more critical of myself. And so I try not to really keep score too much other than that, you know, just try to leave everything you touch a little bit better because you were there and you know, life is good from there.
Oh, I really like that. And it's one of those things where you really have to reflect, especially when you've done many, many different things. And I mean, thinking to the technology side of things, you've obviously touched now on that there's the video streaming, there's the security, the WAF mentioned earlier. Is there a particular area of technology that you really enjoy or that you've enjoyed working with in the past?
Yeah, I just like a lot of different technology. I'm a gadget guy. I'm always, you know, out getting the newest gadget. I've always got the newest update on my computers and my phones. And, you know, I love new features. Although it's interesting, I love that. But I don't do social media. I don't do a lot of those other things. And so, you know, I just think technology is cool. Technology is probably the most powerful, you know, level setter in the world as far as, you know, being able to bring people into, you know, higher levels of income, being able to transform economies and communities into places. I mean, you look at, you know, even third world countries and how technology is actually the reason that they're, you know, lifting up the wealth of their population more than any other thing it's done in the past, probably since the Industrial Revolution. And you know, and we're just getting started. It's just amazing when you think about the possibilities, but there's challenges that come with it too, you know, as you know.
Yeah.
Definitely, it's always scratching the surface. I mean, on that topic quickly, Bob, I've got to ask, Apple or Android?
Apple, for sure. Apple. Well, I say Apple. So I'm an Apple personal device guy. My computers, my laptop, my phones are all Apple. But my TVs are all Fire Sticks, which are Android. Uh-huh. And I have an Android device I just installed in my car. I put a new, you know, a custom entertainment system in there. That's all Android. So, but I, you know, by default, I would say Apple.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. And I mean, it was great to take a real look back at the past and some of the aspects of your career. So I'm now going to hand over to Jake to look at what the present day might hold.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That was really, really interesting. I like that you're off social media. I think it makes perfect sense, right? Using technology rather than letting technology use you. I'm often tempted to come off social media. It's a good shout.
I might use that soundbite. I like that.
Thank you. So we've looked back at some of the key aspects of your career. So it'd be great to have a talk about a little bit of look forward and to the present as well. So you supported enterprise clients to address their security needs during COVID, which itself, of course, triggered a period of accelerated digital transformation. In broad terms, can you outline the cybersecurity challenges businesses are currently facing?
Yeah, so I could talk about this topic for hours, but let me frame it up as simple as I can. You know, the challenge that we have in security is that for the last 20 years, you know, I go back 20 years ago and people didn't even think about security. When I was a developer, a coder, I never thought about security, and you know, CISO wasn't a role you ever talked about. And then it started to become more and more, as the internet became more pervasive, you know, that became more pervasive. But even then, when it did, it was more about endpoints and email and you know what you're doing on your computer and not getting phished and things like that. The landscape has changed significantly. And the reason it's changed is a couple of things. Number one, if you think about how security grew up, you know, kind of like a castle did in the medieval times. You build a big wall, you put guards on the wall, and everything that's important, you stick inside the four walls of the castle. And you put a moat and you have a drawbridge, right? And that's how companies protected. And that was a cybersecurity. It's very perimeter oriented. And if you think about it, you had a SOC that was your guards on the wall. You had, you know, a perimeter defense around your company and everything was sitting in your data center. And that's how you did security. Now, fast forward to today. And you know, the last 10 years has been a world of cloud and SaaS and APIs and headless and all the different terms that we know about. And the reality is now you can't put all your assets in the castle anymore. There is no castle. And so everything's out there in the ether. And so, you know, the couple of things that creates a challenge on. Number one, the whole paradigm of how security has grown up is all broken because you can't, there is no perimeter anymore. Number one. Number two, you know, if I think of my company alone, I'm sitting at home right now doing this podcast. I know that on this network, my son has his Xbox. I know that there's a, you know, other Wi-Fi access points for my sprinkler system, for, you know, gadgets in the kitchen. And that's the attack surface that companies have to think about now. You have remote workers, you've got no perimeter. And the reality is you're trying to solve against the world, not against, you know, a data center that you used to have in your backyard. So that's the challenge that companies have is that, you know, and we're going faster and faster towards, you know, I just mentioned a minute ago, you know, I've got Android devices in my Fire Sticks. I've got my car that sits in the garage. It's, you know, on Wi-Fi. And all those things are, you know, things that companies have to think about. And so security, the challenge with security today is how do you really address a, you know, ubiquitous attack surface with no perimeter that changes every day? And oh, by the way, the bad guys have access to open source and cloud and machine learning just like we do. And so they're getting far more sophisticated as well. I saw a stat recently where, you know, just 5 years ago, it would take, just use raw numbers, it would take a hacker a certain amount of time to do one hack, and they can do 1,000 hacks in that same amount of time today because of machine learning and automation and using cloud. And so they're getting more sophisticated. The attack surface is becoming ever increasing, expansive, actually, you know, boundaryless, if you will. And if you're a CISO or a technology person, you've got to solve that problem because it's real. And oh, by the way, you know, the money you can make off of cybersecurity is going up as well, because more and more, you know, commerce is at the edge. So that's the challenge that you have. And so companies, you know, the reason why it's number one on everybody's list of things they wake up worried about is because of that reason. How do I solve this problem? It's not easy to do. And the ways I've done it and the ways I've grown up doing it for the last 20 years don't work anymore. I don't even know what I'm trying to solve for because my attack surface is, you know, so fluid right now. And so that's the challenge that you have. And so when you look at cybersecurity over the last, you know, 5 to 7 years, it's evolved from more perimeter protection oriented to more analytics and machine learning. And ultimately, you know, I think where security has to go to solve this problem is the only place all these points come together is at the edge. So security has to move to the edge, and it has to be about, you know, real-time intelligence and data gathering and machine learning and analytics. It's the only way you solve this problem. And you're really cutting the time between, you know, potential point of impact to recognition and detection and response and closing that down to almost real time. That's the only way you solve this problem. And that's why you see, you know, the security industry really getting disrupted quite a bit. And a lot of these younger companies that are looking at it this way, you know, looking like sexy unicorn valuations, because it's a big opportunity and a big challenge at the same time.
Fascinating. Thank you. I love the castle analogy. There's no moat, but also there's no castle. Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, by the way, even if you have a castle, your assets don't go in the castle anymore. So what good is it, right? You sit down in the village and the whole paradigm has been turned upside down.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. Very interesting. Very interesting. And leading on from that, what can you tell us about the intersection of video streaming and security? So how interdependent are these two elements, and what innovations are you seeing in this part of the market?
Yeah, I would say they're loosely coupled. In some ways, they're very complementary. In other ways, they're somewhat loosely coupled. Anytime you have digital content delivered over the internet, there's security concerns. Video is more and more moving over the top. And so there's certainly video security concerns. And even if it's not necessarily the content itself, it's how you consume the content, the Fire Sticks that I have, or any other devices that you might use, you know, that's all your accounts that you log into for getting this content. These are all, you know, soft spots that are attack surface. And so you have security nonetheless. But I think the real complementary nature is that the one thing you need to deliver this video is you need a massive network with a lot of scale all over the world, which is what we have and what, you know, a lot of our competitors have. And when you think about where security is going, security has to be at the edge, and you need massive scale and you need massive compute power so that you can take this data real time and very quickly, you know, detect, assess and respond to an issue, an incident, a compromise. And the only way to do that is to have this massive network and massive compute power at the edge. And so where they're complementary is the same compute power that you need for delivering this video can be used to solve the security problem. And that's why it's a very natural thing for us. The issue for us is that not delivering video is not why we think we can be really good at security in this kind of next generation of security. It's because of what the apparatus that we have to deliver that video can also be used to solve the problem that I just talked about, a limitless attack surface, you know, no more walls, no more boundaries, and being able to do, you know, massive data ingestion, machine learning detection and response at the edge, close to where the endpoint is really where security goes. So it's really being able to use that same operating system, if you will, to solve the problem.
Interesting. Very interesting. Thank you. Thank you so much. With recent high profile attacks on Uber and Rockstar Games allegedly committed by an 18-year-old, and information security warfare a key element in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, cybersecurity is never out of the news. What do you think the future holds, and what trends are emerging to combat these threats?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because you look at two dimensions that you know, CISOs have to face and companies have to face. So one, you have state sponsored. And by the way, you know, I would argue that we're in the next version of the Cold War, but this version of the Cold War is not about, you know, nuclear stockpiles. It's about cyber and you know, intelligence. And so, and that's happening. It happens all the time. And then the other thing you point out is, look, any 18-year-old can go to, you know, download some open source tools, go up and use their credit card and open up a cloud account and get massive scale, massive compute power, and have all the powerful tools that the state-sponsored governments have, and you have limitless opportunities. And that's the world we live in. So, you know, it's an equal opportunity for you know, the bad guys, if you will. And companies have to stay one step ahead of that. And so that's the challenge. And by the way, when we see things like DDoS attacks, you know, you don't know, is it state-sponsored? You don't know if it's some 18-year-old kid, you know, sitting in a dorm room. All you know is that they have access. You know, if you go out today and you do a Google search in an open source forum, you can find toolkits that allow you to hack and get into people's environments pretty easily. It's not hard to do. It's just, you got to take the time to read the books and understand it. And so it's, there's not much of a barrier to entry for people at any level.
And what do you think about?
By the way, you have organized crime in there as well. You know, it used to be that organized crime was about, you know, other things. Now this is a big part of organized crime too.
And what do you think are going to be the big key technologies in terms of combating this?
Yeah, definitely it's going to be machine learning, analytics, large data ingestion. The only way you do it is, you know, most attacks are sophisticated. They use multiple points of entry. And so you've got to be able to aggregate data across multiple points in your environment, and then be able to look for, you know, correlations, anomalies, behaviors, patterns, all those types of things. And you have to do it in real time. And so that's the other thing. If you think about security, security's grown up is, hey, I've got an endpoint solution, I've got a server solution, I've got a network solution, and they all sit in islands. The fact is you've got to be able to bring all that together and correlate all that data, because the behaviors across those three data sets are really where you're going to find those needles in the haystack. And that's really what it is finding needles in a haystack. But you have to do that well, and you have to do it in real time.
Great. Thank you. As the CEO of Edgio, and obviously previously Alert Logic, you know better than most the importance of being a successful leader and how crucial that can be to steering a business. Of course, this comes with highs and lows, which brings us to some questions around leadership. What do you think it takes to become a successful leader?
Well, I think first and foremost, you know, you've got to want it. You have to really have a passion for what leadership is. Leadership and management are two very different things. Leadership comes with the responsibility of making tough decisions, giving tough feedback, also being humble and you know, giving other people credit and bringing them along. It's all those things. And so, you know, people, one of the questions you often hear is leadership, you know, are you born with it or can you learn it? I think it's a little of both, honestly. I think it's really baked into the DNA of who you are. One of the things that I actually look at my job as 50% leadership, 50%, whatever I'm doing at the time. And I spend probably half of my time focused on the elements of how to drive leadership at scale. You know, when I'm in my role, I've got to be able to, you know, impute leadership across, you know, thousands of people. And you can't do that by, you know, one conversation at a time. So I've spent a lot of time on not only having one-on-one conversations and group conversations, but putting tools in place. So we have, for example, five values that we have in our company. They're all focused on what good leadership looks like. Every one of our employees knows what those values are. They get trained on it from the day they walk in the company. They hear me talk about it all the time. We hire against them. We promote against them. We, you know, constructively give feedback against them. And they're the values that essentially are not just, you know, creating value for the company, but they're also creating an ecosystem that we all want to be a part of, because we're, you know, a leadership-oriented culture.
Very interesting. Thank you so much. And when you're turning around, because you talked a little bit at the beginning about having, you know, been had the opportunity a few times to turn things around. What is it that you think that you see differently in a situation? What is it perceptively that you see that perhaps others don't, that enable you to bring something around that, look, you know, other people perhaps are not seeing the wood for the tree?
Yeah. There's a couple patterns that you see oftentimes, and it really gets to the values. And I'll talk about the values in a minute, because I think it's really important. And I've developed those over the years of doing turnarounds and saying, look, this is what prevents and how you get out of these messes. But there's a few paradigms. So one is I call it the Icarus paradox. You know, Icarus was the god of flight that, you know, flew too close to the sun and then melted because it was made of wax. And I think a lot of companies and people do that. You know, my early career, when I talked about it, I was wildly successful and I took it too far and then had a big failure. And that was, you know, one of the first lessons I learned is that, you know, what makes you successful in one context isn't necessarily the thing that's going to make you successful in another context. And businesses do one of two things. Either one, they think, because I was successful over here, I'm going to chase this over here and use the same playbook and it doesn't work. Or because I was successful here, I'm going to keep doing this, even though the world's changing around me. So if you were a company 10 years ago doing cybersecurity the way it was 10 years ago, and you're saying, hey, I was successful then, I'm just going to keep double down on it. You're going to fail now because the world's changed, right?
No one wants my moat. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it was a great moat. So that's one. Number two, I think people, just human nature, you know, we're focused on, you know, our kind of limbic state in our brain. You know, we've spent millions of years evolving to find problems and detect, you know, fear or detect danger. And so when companies start to go, you know, sideways, people go into that fight, flight, or freeze mode. And what do you do when you do that? You go to places where you're going to protect yourself and you're going to feel safe, but they aren't necessarily the places, the kind of rational decisions that are needed for business. They're the ones that, you know, you hunker down, right? And you kind of double down on what you have. And so when I go into turnarounds, you typically find that there were some pivots that needed to be made that weren't. People have then gotten entrenched in what they did. And rather than step back and say, we need to really rethink this thing and make some tough decisions, instead they hunker down and they push forward with what they know and what was safe to them in the past. And it becomes this compounding problem. And then eventually, you know, you get to a situation where you're in a hole and then you don't know how to dig out of it. So it you know, all that goes back to biases, the, you know, human nature, the inability to really rationalize your way out of these situations and kind of break down those biases and the heuristics. So I think most of it's that. And by the way, underneath a lot of that, oftentimes there's a lot of egos involved too. You know, you might have a CEO that, you know, pounded the table and said, we're going to do this. I don't really care about all the feedback. You know, there's a lot of those scenarios too, but it still goes down to the same dynamics. You know, biases that were applied to a situation that the situation didn't call for.
That's fascinating. Thank you. Thank you so much. And how do you motivate people to go the extra mile?
You know, I think people, the right people, generally want to motivate themselves when they feel excited and they feel encouraged and good. It goes back to that, you know, fear, fight or flight mode. When you're not in that mode, you generally tend to feel motivated. If you're not, you know, and you're lazy, then that's a different conversation. We don't really want those people in our company. But generally, people, I think, are self-motivated when they're excited about something, they believe in something. So how I try to motivate people is we really focus on building a culture of empowerment, trust, and accountability. And so we give people the empowerment to go do things, be creative, use their whole brain, feel like an owner of the business. One of our values is ownership. We want them to feel like owners. So we empower them to do that. We trust them. We let them make decisions. And by the way, with trust comes, hey, it's okay to make mistakes. You know, we're okay with that as long as you recognize them and you don't and you adjust quickly. But there's also accountability with that. You know, we at the end of the day, we have to deliver on our commitments. And so that accountability comes with that. And we found that generally when you truly build a culture that looks like that, people, you know, pretty much motivate themselves, the right people. Right. You know, and it's little things like, you know, when I came into Alert Logic, we had a vacation policy. We had all kinds of bureaucratic, you know, stuff around it. And I said, look, if we're about trust and empowerment, why do we even have it? Why don't we just tell people if you need time off, take it off. Just use your best judgment, right? And if we're truly about empowerment and trust, let's do that. And so we abolished the policy and told people, right, if you need to take time off, take it off. You don't need to get permission. And it was amazing. People took the time off they needed to. And they love that empowerment and that flexibility. There were a few people that, hey, I want a policy because I want to make sure I use every day of it. And, you know, those are the people that, you know, are probably not fit for our culture. You know, it's little things like that. And it's bigger things like, you know, letting them make big decisions on investments and so forth as well.
Great. Thank you. It's great to hear you map those core values to how you motivate people within a workforce. Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah. You know, if you don't mind, I'll spend a minute and I'll take you.
Please do. I was hoping you would. Thank you.
Yeah. They're really important. So this, think of it as a centerpiece and then four legs of the table. And so the centerpiece is client obsessed. You know, that's pretty easy. We wake up every day and, you know, ask the question, are we doing the right thing for our clients? You know, we really think about that as a stakeholders, because employees and shareholders are in there as well. But client, if you don't solve for clients, you can't solve for shareholders. If you don't solve for clients and shareholders, you can't solve for employee value. So we start with clients. And then the four legs of that are first team is a really important one. And first team, if you've ever played competitive sports with a team sport, you know what the behaviors are in that dynamic. Like if you played soccer, if you played football or basketball, you know, when you're competing on the field, everybody knows the role they need to play. There's hyper communication, there's accountability, there's trust. Everybody has to do their part. Sometimes you're high-fiving, sometimes you're giving somebody some constructive feedback, but it's real time, it's intense. And so that's what First Team's all about. We believe in feedback. We believe in collaboration. You got to trust that the other person's going to do their job and let them do their job and focus on your job. So First Team is an important one. Design thinking is another one. Design thinking goes back to what I said earlier, where sometimes you got to step back and say, are we really solving the right problem? Or did we, you know, miss a turn somewhere along the way because things shifted on us and we didn't shift with it? And so design thinking is always about stepping back and saying, you know, let's look at the context we're in and have some tough conversations about what adjustments and course corrections we need to make. Ownership is another really important one. Ownership is really simple. If you ever go into an establishment that is privately run, you know, restaurant or a small store, you can almost pick out the owner. You don't need to have them tell you they're the owner. You could see the behaviors, right? They pay attention to every detail. They're focused on the things that matter. You can also see who the employees are, who are just doing what they're supposed to do and not really caring about much else. And so, you know, there's a set of behaviors that come with ownership that go above and beyond just kind of doing your job and punching the clock. And so ownership is those set of behaviors, you know, really take it to the next level. And then last is performance. Performance is all about, you know, stuff that I missed early in my career when I had my failure, which is, you know, you got to know your numbers. You got to know the details of how you're going to drive the plan, and just, you know, feeling good about your strategy and saying you're dynamic and charismatic is not enough. You've got to actually have detailed plans. You got to measure your business, understand your assumptions and all that kind of stuff. So when you tie it all together, you know, you end up with, we're going to create a great culture around First Team where people work together and have that high performing, you know, culture. We're going to always ask ourselves, you know, should we make adjustments? Is there a better way to do this? You know, should we make changes? We want people who act like owners, and we're going to empower them to be owners, but we want them to behave like owners. And then we're going to be very detailed and manage, you know, manage the details with plans, with dates, with names, with KPIs and metrics. And those are the four values. And when you do those four things right, it's amazing. They're pretty simple, but it's amazing when you do those four things right, how much value you can create in any kind of environment.
Yeah, it's inspiring. Thank you. Thank you. Really interesting. And on to another core topic now with Henry.
Bob, that was fascinating to hear, and I'm sure we could have continued speaking about that for the rest of the duration. But I mean, a topic which is really important to us, and I know the same with Edgio, is diversity and inclusion. This is something which we always like to talk with our leaders about, and possibly taking a step back at how things have changed, but where they're at the moment. I'm sure across your career, you've seen this go both ways. But how have you seen things improve when it comes to diversity and inclusion?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. If you had asked me 5 years ago, I'd say things have gotten a lot better. And then I look at today and you know, just everybody's so angry at each other. And it feels like we've taken a step backwards. I don't know why, to be honest with you. I have a couple thoughts on that. I think, you know, diversity and inclusion, how you're framing up in a more traditional sense is an important topic. And I'll talk about that. But I also think there's another version of it, which is just diversity of perspective, experience, and thought. It isn't necessarily about, you know, race and gender. That is an important conversation for sure, but it's also important that you don't surround yourself with people that, you know, think like you, act like you. And a lot of companies do that. You got to have, I believe that the magic happens when there's friction, and friction is when there's differences of perspective. And that naturally comes with, you know, physical differences as well, but, you know, it needs to be, you know, experiential differences too. So I think, you know, on the differences of perspective, we drive that through a tool we call Whole Brain. Which aligns with our values, by the way. And we really look for, you know, most people naturally think in one or two quadrants of the brain. Think about your brain having four quadrants. So you hear people say your right brain or left brain or top brain or bottom brain. There's actually science behind that. So right brain, you know, top right is more of a big picture, you know, our design thinking value. Bottom right is more about interpersonal. How do I feel about somebody? Do I like them? Do I not like them? First 30 seconds, you decide if you like somebody. That's kind of like First Team. Top left is your logic. And, you know, that's kind of like the ownership one. Hey, are we doing the right thing? Should we? Why are we doing this? And then bottom left is just kind of tactical punch list stuff. And most people have a primary quadrant that they use and a secondary, and then two others they don't use. And so if you're right brain, like a Steve Jobs is very right brain, very visionary, very emotional as well. He always had a sidekick, right, who was his left brain person, who was no personality, but very scientific. Same thing with Bill Gates. And there's a reason for that. The two of them together, Ballmer and Gates, brought together that Whole Brain kind of model. So we try to drive that. We train our people for that, and we hire for that. I look at myself and I share it with the whole company. I happen to be, you know, more right brain, well, top brained actually, big picture and logic. And so therefore, I need to make sure that I'm complementing my skill set with people that focus on the bottom brain things, focus on the details and drive the plans. It goes back to my early career, right? I learned that lesson the hard way. So we drive that. That's an important piece. But on the other, the more traditional side of diversity, I think we're focused on the wrong end of the telescope. Look, we're getting better. We're not good enough. If I look at tech, if you go across boards and you go across the management teams in the tech space, there's not a lot of diversity. There just isn't. And what you hear is people saying you got to hire. The reality is though is that there's not a lot of candidates to pick from. And so I think what we need to do is we need to start challenging companies not to focus on, hey, who are you hiring and how are you driving? Because that actually, I think, works against. I've seen companies where they said, hey, I need you to hire somebody who's in a minority represented group, even if they're not qualified, because we need to do that. And that actually creates more resentment for other people. And I actually don't think that helps. What we need to do is we need to focus on getting more candidates and really getting more people into STEM careers. And so, as an example, I mentioned earlier that I have a foundation I started about, I was 12, 13 years ago. And what we do is we actually work in and challenge communities, and we help younger kids with scholarships and mentoring and development and get them into STEM careers so that they can, become, future engineers. And I think if more companies did more of that kind of thing, you think about it, take cybersecurity. There are about 4.5 million unfilled jobs right now in the world for cybersecurity. And that's a role where, it doesn't matter where you came from. It doesn't matter if you have purple hair. It doesn't matter if you have earrings, in your nose. Nobody cares. All they care about is, can you do the job? And there's 4.5 million jobs that are high paying jobs, by the way, that could be accessible to people that could change their life, where they are today. And the only thing standing between that opportunity and where they are is somebody to help them close that gap of, how do I even understand how I get into this career and get into school and get the training that I need? And so I would challenge more companies to find ways to get on the front end of this problem and really get more candidates. What I found is people just want to hire the best people. We just need more candidates to drive diversity. So we've got to focus on that end of the telescope, in my opinion.
Grassroots. Mm.
Well, it's fascinating to hear, Bob, and really impressive as well about the foundation side of things, because it is such a grassroots problem. And really echoing to that first point as well, it's about having diverse thoughts and challenging one another instead of thinking we need to fill a quota just for the sake of it. And it's certainly a topic that we could continue talking about for ages. But on a separate side of things, we are a curious bunch, and we always like to ask, what is your idea of a perfect weekend?
So my day is so hectic during the week. A perfect weekend, really relaxing. I do a lot of yard work. I play maybe some pickleball or racquetball with my neighbor. Lay in a hammock for a little bit, read a book. I play guitar, so I'll do a little of that. But really low key, maybe go out to dinner. I'm really not a very exciting person outside of work, and I'm okay with that.
Oh, no, I don't say that at all, Bob. But now
it sounds lovely. Very relaxing.
I'm one of those people that I could be by myself for 2 days and just be perfectly fine with that and be happy. In fact, probably be in a better mood, because I don't feel like I'm having to spend energy worried about anybody else.
No, I understand that. Now into our quick fire round, Bob. So no thinking here. We'll just pick you off your feet. Listed 10 questions. So here we go. Are you a city or country person?
Country, for sure. Yeah.
Netflix or Disney Plus?
I grew up in the city, and I now live out in the country, and I definitely like the country better. It's quieter and easier going.
I'm with you there for sure. Netflix or Disney Plus?
Netflix.
Nice. Plane or train?
What's that?
Plane or train?
Well, I would say train. When I lived in Boston and New York, I'd take the train all the time, even though the plane was quicker, but it was just so much more relaxing and casual. You get up and walk around, go grab a beer, whatever, Wi-Fi. Planes and airports stress me out, and I'm on them all the time, but definitely train if I can.
A bit of a silly question, especially after IBC. I'm thinking back to it.
Good point.
Certainly. What is your favorite game of sport to watch or play?
Probably college basketball. Yeah, I love college basketball. I like college football too, but college basketball for sure is my favorite.
Would you rather ride a bike, ride a horse, or drive a car?
Well, I have a motorcycle, so I'd probably add that to the list, and I'd rather.
What have you got? What motorbike have you got?
I've got a Victory Vision and a Harley Fat Boy. And that's, you know, part of my, you know, on a Sunday, I'll take a, I live in the country. So I'll take a ride through the country, and I live in horse country, and it's really nice. So I'll do that. You know, car, not so much. I actually, my neighbor has horses and I'll ride those once in a while, but you know, it doesn't, it's okay, but not like riding a motorcycle where nobody can bother you. Crank the music up and just, you know, ride around.
I just looked up a Victory Vision as we were speaking. It looks like it's going to take off. Yeah, amazing.
You know, it's what you expect with motorcycles. Surround sound, heated seats, heated handlebars. Right. You know,
very nice. Excellent.
If you could live anywhere in the world, where would it be?
You know, I got to tell you, where I am now is fine. I travel all the time, all over the world. And usually after about 4 days, I'm looking forward to getting home. You know, I'm simple. I like the weather's great here. The people are nice here. You know, if I had to pick somewhere other than here, I don't know, maybe Spain, but I have a feeling that, you know, I'd probably after about 6 months be ready to come back here. So, you know, I guess it's a good thing when you can say you're really happy with where you are. And I can say that for sure.
Oh, brilliant. And one last question before we take a bit of a detour. What is your favorite family vacation spot?
Oh, boy. The ones where you don't do anything. So my wife likes to do beach vacations. I'm not a big beach guy, but I'll go there and just kind of hang out in a hammock and, you know, be happy. You know, honestly, if I can go somewhere and just sit by a pool, read a book and take walks and, you know, relax, that's a great vacation for me. Just downtime, really, is nice. And I like to be outside and I like warm weather. So if you just give me warm weather outside and by a pool, I'm great.
Brilliant. Switch off all the devices, fully relax. No, I love it, Bob. And I'm really interesting to hear all your thoughts there. And what our final question is always the same. What is one piece of advice you would give to someone entering the industry?
Yeah, I'd give advice for anybody. And my, you know, my son's just graduated from college, and you know, I'd give him the same advice. You know, number one, find your own version of those values that I shared. It's really important. Number two, don't take yourself too seriously. You know, really just be willing to step back and be a constant learner. I've been a student. I've probably been more of a student since I got out of school than when I was in school. I read all the time. I'm constantly learning. I'm learning from people, situations, books, whatever. And then third, you know, just be content with, could I make this situation better because I was in it in my own capacity? And that's got to be enough. You know, we live in a world where people are always judging. There's always somebody that's got a point of view on what you should or shouldn't do. And I think it's driving some of the anger. I think it drives a lot of the anxiety you see in kids today. You know, we've got to find a way where people feel content that, you know what, I did enough and I did what I could. And that's good enough. And I think if people can figure out those three things, you know, they'll do well in life.
Oh, thank you for sharing, Bob. Really inspiring to hear. And that is everything from us. Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Likewise. Thanks, guys. I really enjoyed it. And if I can do anything for you in the future, let me know. But I really enjoyed the conversation. I enjoyed getting to know you at IBC, Henry. So I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you enjoyed it, please do subscribe and give us a rating. It really helps these stories to be found and enjoyed by more people. For more information about NewCo, we can be found at www.newco-group.com. That's NEUCO-group.com.